Hi, friends. Welcome to True Crime with Ivana Estelle. I'm your host, and today it is just you and I. And honestly, maybe that's how it should be, because this case right here, it is a doozy, and I need to chat with you about it. See, betrayal has been the theme of this season, and this is a story about two women who found themselves in a situation where they had to protect those closest to them, even when it seemed that they were destined to get hurt by their loved ones. And in one woman's case, it led to the loss of her life. I know you know what it's like to want what's best for someone, to love someone, and they just keep doing you wrong. And I hope you have the ability to walk away, because some people aren't so lucky. This is the story of Shirley Carter. Welcome to Marion County, Iowa, also considered Pleasantville, your typical middle America farmland. The population is about 33,000 people, and it actually has one of the lowest unemployment rates I have ever seen at 2.2%. That's probably because most people are working in the country on the farm. It's where 67-year-old Shirley Carter lived with her husband, Bill. They owned a 900-acre soybean and corn farm, and Shirley raised three children there, two sons and a daughter, Bill Jr., Jason, and Jana Lynn. This past summer, I went to visit the house my Nana's parents lived in years ago in Danville, Virginia, and it was just acres upon acres of farmland. There would be a house here and there, and there were local bars and restaurants. I would imagine that this is what Marion County was like. People were quiet where Shirley lived. They kept to themselves, which is why on June 19th, 2015, everything changed drastically when a frantic Jason Carter called police, informing them that his mother, Shirley, had been shot to death in the kitchen. Shirley was a family woman, and on the farm you had to be. She had her own John Deere tractor. There are photos of her smiling proudly in front of it. Shirley wasn't about the ruffles and the frills. She was a hardworking woman. She kept her chestnut brown hair either down or pulled back with a bandana. She usually wore a big smile. In her free time, she spent with her grandkids and her husband. Shirley and Bill Carter had been married for 52 years. I mean, they were forever partners. Bill describes his love for Shirley as his everything. He said in interviews, quote, "I never had any trouble, even when we were married young. We just never had anything or any trouble." He's devastated, quite frankly, anytime anyone brings Shirley up. The two plan to spend the rest of their lives together. And to him, Shirley's death was sudden. But what if there was more to the story? Mark Ludwig was on the scene of the case and held the position of lead investigator. In his opinion, something was off that day. See, upon entering the home, Shirley was found in the kitchen that morning. Her hands were crossed on her chest and she was laying on her back. There was blood on the floor of the kitchen, and it appeared that whoever did this knew Shirley. I mean, there were no signs of a break-in. She was dead on arrival, and once they found her, police were able to decipher the murder weapon as a rifle. Later on, they were able to determine that there were two bullet holes in the chest causing Shirley's death. Mark was suspicious of all the men in the family, Bill Sr., Bill Jr., and Jason in particular. See, Jason was the one who made the call to police. In a frantic interaction with the 911 operator, you can hear Jason screaming that someone must have come in and shot her. But he also mentioned something specific, that she must have been laying there for 2 hours. This triggered Mark. How did Jason know that? I'm going to play for you the 911 call now. These calls are always tricky because we don't have an 100% response to how to handle certain calls. Like, they're tricky. If you're calling in a murder or an accident, what have you, If you sound more frantic, it could be considered acting. If you sound calm, it can be considered monotone or uncaring. I've heard many different 911 calls, being a true crime listener myself, and I have got to say the debate is the same. If you're overzealous and acting crazy, it's both understandable and seems like you are putting on a performance. If you are calm and straight to the point, it seems like you are trying to keep it together, but also may not care.
911, where is your emergency?
Yes.
We're in the
dark.
To what address?
In Ferry.
So, where was Jason Carter on June 19th? Camera footage had shown him at a local construction store. Think like a Home Depot or Lowe's drop-off site. Earlier in the day, it could be assumed that Jason had last seen his mother alive a couple hours ago and assumed the murder occurred right after he left. There wasn't much about Jason Carter in general. He kind of appeared as more of a nerdy, shy guy. He was short and stout with glasses and graying hair. He kept to himself. He and his wife had been married for some years, but as police began to investigate Jason, they learned that he did have some secrets. One being an extramarital affair that he was having over the past few months. Police searched the family home and Jason's car. Now, it isn't clear if Jason willingly gave the car up or if there was a warrant, but police did find a local fuse box holding a cell phone that Jason was using to text a mystery woman. Now, what the fuse box was doing in the car? Clearly, it was to keep away from his family. And I guess the thing is, what does that have to do with Shirley's murder? Does it have anything to do with her murder? Not necessarily. Unless, in some strange scenario, Shirley was threatening to reveal the affair to Jason's wife. What it did do was bring doubt in police's eyes. When they initially questioned Jason, he mainly spoke about the murder, and there was no one that he could think of that would want to hurt his mother. He did not mention that he was having an affair, though, and police began to view him as a liar, or at least someone who would withhold information. Police immediately, from that day, decided to zero in on Jason. Within 3 days of the murder, Jason was brought back into the local police station for further questioning. Police also took in Shelley Carter, Jason's wife. Now, I know you're dealing with a lot of players here, so let me give a recap. There is Billy Carter, Sr., Shirley Carter's husband. Billy and Shirley's 3 kids, Bill Jr., Jason, and Jana. Jason Carter, the younger son who found Shirley Carter in the kitchen. And Shelley Carter, Jason's wife, who was also brought in for questioning with Jason 3 days after Shirley's murder. Police had basically set their sights on Jason. They found him suspicious, and in doing so, there wasn't any clarity on an alibi for Bill Sr. or Bill Jr., at least not yet anyway. Jana actually did have an alibi, only because Jason had called her from the crime scene before calling the police to tell her that he'd found their mom dead. Now, let's get back to Shelley Carter, because as she is sitting in the precinct, she has no idea that her husband has been having an affair. I will pause here for dramatic effect. She finds out from the police that her husband has been cheating on her while being questioned on her whereabouts and her husband Jason's whereabouts in regard to Jason's mother's murder. Hell would have frozen over in that room. The apocalypse would have truly begun if I was in a police station being questioned about my husband because the police thought he killed his mother. And on the same day, I found out that that son of a bitch is cheating on me. But being a shitty husband doesn't necessarily correlate to being a murderer. Well, actually, it does in a lot of cases, but usually the victim is the wife. In this case, Jason's mom was dead, and what police were trying to figure out is if their hunch was right, then what was the motive? The interrogation of Jason would last 11 hours. Which, could you imagine, 11 hours? And no attorney, might I add. In the beginning, it appeared that the police were on Jason's side. They gave their condolences. And then a lie detector test was brought up, which Jason agreed to take. Y'all already know what I'm about to say, so feel free to skip ahead 15 seconds as I get in on this rant. Always ask for a lawyer. I don't care if you've been accused of stealing a fucking Snickers bar from a gas station. You get a lawyer. And never take a polygraph test. Does that even sound like a real test? Like a test that can tell if you're lying. You mean to tell me that we live in a world where we can't find a cure for most major diseases? Where we haven't been able to get another person on the moon in years, yet we have a machine that can detect when someone is lying? How is that even possible? It's not. It only detects your heart rate, essentially. So it's an assumption. And if you are like me or any other person who has made it through the last decade in these states alone, you probably have a bit of anxiety. And there's a strong chance if you were hooked up to that machine, you'd appear to either be inconclusive, deceptive, or, if you really pass, indeceptive. Even if you are truly being completely honest. Needless to say, Jason was found deceitful. While this test was going on, Shelley Carter was being questioned. From her perspective, it was to turn on her husband. Police were trying to gather as much evidence as they could on Jason, from Shelley's view. Shelley had also been cleared she had an alibi for her whereabouts that day. Jason failed on the questions regarding if he knew who hurt his mom. Jason responded no, he did not. Now, while all this is going on, the Carter family is in shock. Bill Sr. actually considered Jason Carter his, quote, favorite son. Now, of course, this is a strange thing to say, considering he only had two sons, which would make one wonder, what was the family dynamic like? Where was Bill Jr. during this time? Could there have been a strain between the siblings? Regardless of the test results, Jason maintained his innocence. Jason explained he loved his mother. He was the one to find her dead. He had nothing to do with this murder. Police, however, were not buying it. They didn't agree with his description of the crime scene. See, Jason claimed that there was blood everywhere, while police claimed when they arrived there was minimal blood. Jason explained that he walked in and found his mother dead, and during the interrogation, Jason was getting more and more angry. And honestly, it was understandable. In the interrogation, Jason can be heard saying, "If my mom was alive right now, she would strike both of your asses dead." He was speaking to the detectives that were interrogating him. Again, one could see this as a violent person. But on the other hand, could you imagine being accused of killing your mother? How sick and twisted, especially if you're innocent. But police weren't buying it. So what else did police have outside of a polygraph test and a shaky 911 call? There wasn't any evidence that showed they tested Jason's hands for gunpowder residue. They had Jason on camera at the store 2 hours prior. But police believed that this murder was orchestrated by Jason. The house had been ransacked. There were drawers that were opened and papers flung everywhere and strung through. Jason had brought this up to his dad before police arrived. Jason had also apparently shown police upon their arrival that it looked like his father and mother had been robbed. Bill Sr.'s office had clearly been destroyed. And in the bedroom, Shirley's delicates drawer had been ransacked, but her purse sat on their granddaughter's high chair, and it had been untouched. So if the Carters were robbed, what exactly was stolen? The next question, who would rob them? Remember, this is the country. Houses are miles apart. On one hand, you could say it's too far to steal, but also argue these houses that are spread apart are great for stealing because there aren't many witnesses. I mean, there is a devil's advocate response for every piece of this case. Police believe that the crime scene was staged as a robbery, and that's why nothing of value was actually taken. What made things more suspicious, the person that alerted the police and Bill Carter to the apparent robbery, was Jason. The office clearly looked like it had been messed up, but outside of the dresser in the bedroom, everything else kind of looked pretty normal. Then there was the bullets. One had gone through the floor and the other through the refrigerator. Before police could even spot the holes themselves, Jason had apparently peeked them out. Now, the casing's bullets clearly indicated that it was a rifle, but that rifle had never been found. Jason told police that he believed it was his father's rifle that he kept in the basement that also happened to be missing at the time. A Remington Bolt Action 270, to this day, has not been retrieved. After 11 hours of interrogation, it was Shelley Carter who demanded that the interrogation on Jason be done. There's a lot of betrayal happening here now. I mean, Shelley was betrayed by her husband, but still stood by him. She never at one moment believed that her husband was capable of killing his mom. And quite frankly, to be interrogated for 11 hours straight and not crack is, if anything, impressive. But there was also the betrayal of Shirley Carter. I mean, if Jason did do this, then that would mean that he pre-planned to do it, acted it out, and then tried to lead investigators and his dad to possible motives. But if he didn't do this, then who was responsible? At this point, 3 days into the investigation, it didn't seem like Bill Sr. or Bill Jr. had been questioned. It wasn't clear how much they'd been looked into. It also wasn't clear how much had been looked into Shirley's life. I mean, it seemed like she really did keep to herself and her family, so she didn't have any enemies. But there was a missing family gun. It was starting to feel like this investigation was going in circles. So, the gun safe, where Bill Sr.'s other rifles were held. If the murder weapon was the missing rifle, then the killer had access to it. Jason claimed that he didn't know about the safe or the lock on it, but he'd seen it open and empty when he went to the basement the day of his mom's murder. However, Bill Sr. claimed that that was a lie, and that the safe was actually a gift from one of his kids that past Christmas. There was a photograph that would later be found of Jason assembling the gun case for his father, Bill Sr., on Christmas Day. Next was the bullet holes. Police were able to determine during the autopsy that Shirley had been shot twice, but Jason apparently knew before the results were even revealed. And he discussed it with his father. Like, during this whole time that Jason calls the police and his dad gets there, it's almost as if Jason is walking his father through. Like, she was shot twice. Look, here are the bullet holes. There's a missing gun in the basement. It looks like we've been robbed. Kind of setting the scene almost. And then he repeats it again with the police. Meanwhile, there has still been no explanation on Bill Sr. or Bill Jr.'s whereabouts during the murder. Now, the case kind of stalls at this point, after Jason's interrogation. In fact, a year passes and the case was beginning to turn cold, with one prime suspect and little to no evidence. This was when Bill Sr. decided to take Jason to court in a wrongful death suit. This suit was for about $10 million, and wrongful death suits aren't always about the money. Sometimes they are about getting justice and setting blame when the justice system cannot. Bill Sr. knows his son doesn't have millions of dollars. But if he could find a way to get him to take responsibility for the murder of Shirley, that would be enough. The last conversation Bill Sr. and Jason had was when Bill said that he was going to see a lawyer to file a lawsuit against Jason. Jason's response was hitting his hands against the table and saying, "My life is over." The family was ripped apart from this. The civil trial received national attention. It was all over the news. Jason's interview was somber and sad. He recounted the day that he found his mother. He was in shock and then called his sister and police. Law enforcement was hoping to use the civil trial as help for the criminal trial. The jury took 2 hours to deliberate and found Jason liable and said that he had to pay $10 million to his father. It felt like a step in the right direction, as the prosecution decided that they finally had enough evidence to bring this to trial. 2.5 years later, Jason was arrested for the murder of Shirley Carter. Immediately, the courts brought a plea deal of 5 years in prison to Jason Carter. I wonder if it was like an Alford plea or for manslaughter, but we'll never know because it was Shelley Carter who pushed Jason to take this to trial. And they did. I want to take note here. One of my favorite podcasts, Sisters Who Kill, has like a song that plays when they get to the trial portion of these cases they cover. I don't have that, but I am channeling that as I get to this part. Shelley is a loyal woman, okay? She was riding for her man. Jason had a lot on the line, his reputation and children of his own. The prosecution began by saying this was an act of greed. Not only would Jason be covering up his affair, but if he was able to kill his father that day too, he'd have the opportunity to get his parents' farm, which was valued at $6 million. Have your ears perked up? Because mine did. According to the prosecution, Jason didn't want to help run the farm. He allegedly even said, quote, "I could never go into business with that bitch," referring to his mother. Now, what isn't clear is the fact that there were three children. So was the farm left to the three of them to split? What if Bill Jr. and Jana wanted to run the farm? These questions aren't answered. The defense painted a different picture of Jason and Shirley's relationship. Apparently, the mother-son duo were close, and they loved each other. Now, in an attempt not to confuse you with any more names, I'm going to mention one of the witnesses for the prosecution, who was an equipment salesman that had a close relationship with the Carters. Apparently, he described the relationship between Shirley and Jason as strained. Basically, Jason did not want to work with his mother. This case is really hard, guys, because it is not crazy to think that a child doesn't want to go into business with their parent. I don't have to tell you how complicated and complex parent and children relationships can be. The defense did their best to describe a strong relationship between Jason and his mother, Shirley. And the prosecution did their best to share the opposite. And when the prosecution brought Bill Sr. to the stand, it seemed that they had their strongest witness yet. When questioned about the relationship between Jason and Shirley, Bill Sr. testified that Jason, at the time of the murder, was in debt, and that Bill wanted Jason to work with him on the family farm to help him with his finances. But Shirley was set on that not happening. Apparently, Jason was in about $150,000 in debt. Bill Sr. was distraught on the stand, and I mean, he expressed that he loved Jason and he was heartbroken. Bill Sr. also explained that he found Shirley with her hands crossed and her eyes closed on the ground. Now, here is where things get weird. On the stand, Bill is clear as day, saying that Shirley's eyes were closed. But in the interview done by the documentary Killer Cases, Bill Sr. says that Shirley's eyes were open. Not only that, but on the stand, Bill Sr. claims that he held his wife's dead body, which means that he had to have found her as well with Jason before police arrived and after Jason called the police. But my question is, why are you touching what is now a crime scene? It's just something to note. Defense attorney Christine Bransan brought up the surveillance video of Jason. Remember the one I mentioned earlier where he's leaving his truck and he's at some sort of like Home Depot, Lowe's, something construction-y store? Well, apparently it was a drop-off site. He drove a truck that would drop off crops and things to like certain stations. And not only that, but that station was about an hour away from Shirley and Bill Sr.'s house. Christine also brought in Cyril Wecht, a forensic pathologist, on the stand. Cyril testified to the time of death being at least 2 hours prior to Shirley being found, which was around the time that Jason was at the store. Remember, it takes an hour to get from the house to the store and then an hour to get back. The defense then called Mark Ludwig, the lead investigator. I know this has to have you all on the edge of your seat. The goal was to show that Mark and his team hadn't looked into any tips or leads outside of Jason, which included three men named Joel Followill, John Followill, and Joe Sedlock. They were three local criminals who were around the area during Shirley's time of death. Nor had investigators really looked into Bill Sr. or Bill Jr. Now, I'm not going to lie, they ate Mark up on cross-examination. They were able to show that no one else was fully investigated. And let's just say Jason hired these men, or hired someone in general. Well, none of the three men that I stated, or anyone else for that matter, was found in connection to the murder. Which means that the assumption is that Jason acted alone. By trial day 7, the defense rests. It was time for deliberation. So, was Jason a cold-blooded killer who was in debt hiding secrets? Was this a burglary that went wrong? Or was someone else close to Shirley the one to blame? 2 hours of deliberation, similar to the civil suit. The jury had a verdict. Jason Carter was found not guilty. Let me take a breath. After the verdict, the prosecution doubled down that Jason Carter was responsible. Bill Carter Sr. was devastated. He wanted some sort of answer, because at this point, we are now a cold case. A broken family is the result. Jason and Shelley are now counter-suing Bill Sr., Mark Ludwig, and the state of Iowa. Jason Carter is a free man. He was acquitted in 2019. In 2020, authorities in Marion County said officers responded to Bill Carter's home after receiving a 911 call stating he was lying in the road with injuries to his head. He had been assaulted by his son, Bill Jr. According to court documents, Bill Jr. told authorities that he'd gotten into an argument with his father that ended with him knocking his father to the ground and kicking him in the head twice. He was arrested and given a $5,000 bond. As of 2020, there was a no-contact order placed between the eldest son and his father. The final thing I want to note is that the only interview that was done regarding Bill Sr.'s interrogation or conversation with the police was shared on iowacoldcases.com. Bill claimed to the police he dropped off Shirley at the couple's home, 132 Perry Street, after a morning coffee run, before heading out to haul corn, which he and his son Jason did on contract. Before leaving the house, Bill told his wife that he'd be home between 11 and 11:30 a.m. Bill said Jason was 17 minutes behind him in line. And while Bill went on to haul another load from elsewhere, Jason went to his parents' house. In an in-depth Des Moines Register article published a year later on June 20th, 2016, Bill recalled how he was returning home in his 18-wheeler when his cell phone rang. The caller was his adult daughter, Jana, who was living in Centerville. She claimed she received a phone call from Jason, who told her he found their mother dead in their parents' kitchen. After arriving home, Bill said he found his wife's body on the kitchen floor in a pool of blood. Her arms folded across her chest. It looked like she was sleeping, he said, followed by, "I kissed her." Thank you all for joining me today. For our true crime fact, I am covering a Halloween-themed fact. By the time you all are listening to this, it is November 1st, which means Halloween was yesterday. But this is from goodhousekeeping.com. Taking candy from strangers on one night a year, and only one night, isn't a new or uniquely American tradition. Back then, it was known as guising. In Scotland and Ireland, young people dressed up in costumes and went door to door looking for food or money in exchange for performing songs, poems, or other tricks. Today, the tradition has morphed into children getting dressed up and asking for candy. Hardly anyone sings for their mini Snickers these days, but a simple thank you does go a long way. You can find all my sources and photos on YvonneEstelle.com. Please message or DM me letting me know your thoughts on this case. As of now, it doesn't seem like the case is being picked up, as the state feels they found their killer, and Jason's family is trying to have it reinvestigated. With that, safe journey, keep walking in the light, with love. Until next time, Ivana Estelle.